You're broken down and tired of living life on a merry-go-round. And you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to WOLB 1010 AM Talk Radio, featuring Team Radio Baltimore. This is Carol Mileta, your host of Parenting 411, where we share information parents need from sources they can trust. Well, we have moved past the inauguration of a new president and the activation of a new administration and the drama in the weeks leading up to it. We are now focused on the race to get vaccinations to as many people as possible to stem the tide of COVID infections and related deaths in our nation. Our target is 1.5 million vaccinations a day, and we're not there yet, but at least it seems like there is help on the horizon, albeit a long horizon. That will bring peace to many, but there will be challenges remaining, including financial despair, job losses, business closures, and of course, the racial unrest, the not entirely unrelated dysfunction in our political system, and the intransigent views about the validity about our most recent presidential election. Healing from these ills will take much, much longer. And very importantly, the healing must be intentional. We can't wait for this to simply pass. We have to acknowledge these and other instances of trauma in our lives if we are to heal and live a life we love. Now, joining me today to speak on the topic, Overcoming Trauma, Reclaiming Peace in a Pandemic, is Dr. Lori Hood. I had the pleasure of meeting her in 2019 when she delivered a captivating TEDx talk on breaking the trauma power cycle. She is a neuropsychologist with special areas of expertise in trauma and human potential. I'm very interested in what she has to say about surviving and thriving during and after this pandemic. I hope we will get an opportunity to talk about some of the other fascinating work she does and her journey to this space. Welcome, Dr. Lori Hood.
Hi, Carol. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, this is, you know, it's, I would like to say it's my pleasure. We are going to be talking about a heavy topic, but I want to assure our listeners that we're not going to take you down and leave you there. We're going to come away with some strategies. And we know that tough times happen in our lives, and I just am looking forward to hearing what Dr. Lori Hood can tell us about how to get through this tough time. So to just get us started, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to this space and came into this expertise?
Sure. So I'm a neuropsychologist and I focus on trauma. And I've been researching and addressing trauma and human potential for decades, really. And I realized pretty early on in my journey that there was a better way to approach trauma than what we've been doing. And actually have a room on Clubhouse called Stop Fixing Trauma. My feeling is that we try to fix people in that we try to make them like they were before a traumatic situation. And I feel like somehow shifting that expectation might be helpful. So trauma happens sort of individually. It doesn't So what would traumatize me doesn't traumatize you, right? And I learned a lot about this going through my own trauma. And you mentioned my TEDx talk. I was married to an abusive husband and suffered trauma through that situation and was first diagnosed with PTSD in 2008 and then again in 2010. So I had a lot of motivation to learn about trauma at a deeper level. And so I do come at it differently. And that's kind of how I got to the space.
And so during the time that you were experiencing personal trauma, were you already a neuropsychologist or did it prompt you to go into that area?
So I was already in my PhD program at UVA, and I switched. I was actually researching profoundly intelligent children, and because of what happened to us, I sort of crossed over. I still have a deep interest in highly gifted and profoundly gifted kids, and I'm a parent. So, but I did start looking for deeper ways within research to understand what was happening to myself and then thus my kids, and how to parent them through this extremely traumatic situation that took years. So I have a little bit of personal experience in parenting kids through crisis and through crises.
And that's certainly why I wanted you to come on today. Tell us a bit about what your work looks like in neuropsychology, trauma, and human potential. How do you work with people? How do people access you?
So I was a licensed therapist at the master's level for years and years, and I actually, instead of desiring to become a clinician, but I do so through a coaching structure, and I'll tell you why. With trauma, feeling safe and seen and heard and accepted is really, really important. And I didn't want to approach my client from sort of a top-down perspective. And what I mean by that is most times, as a psychologist, you're the doctor, and you, because of insurance and other things, you have to develop a treatment plan. You have to sort of, you have to diagnose a patient and then go from there. And I'm a firm believer that labels can actually do more harm than good. We need labels within professional fields. Like if you're a lawyer, you have to know the lingo and legal speak and legalese. If you're a psychologist, it's nice to know what diagnoses are if you're dealing with mentally ill people. But I was dealing with traumatized people, and I was dealing with children. And so my take on it is if you create a label, you will kind of find it. So I work under a coaching structure. People can find me at my website, which is LoriHoodPhD.com, and Lori has an E on it. It's a little more difficult. But trauma also masquerades as a lot of other things, and often people are often misdiagnosed with things like bipolar disorder or any number of things, when actually they're just suffering from the post symptoms or post trauma symptoms. So I do look at it a little differently. And I also, I work in a somatic way. So I work with the physical body to help people process and recover from trauma.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you're an expert in mass trauma. So what are examples of that, for our listeners to kind of understand what kind of situations that might be? And then I just wonder, would the current pandemic fall into that category?
Absolutely. I mean, so mass trauma is just an event that has the potential for traumatizing a large group or a mass of people, right? So just like individual trauma, it is it's experienced uniquely. But if you have a large stressor or potentially traumatic situation, it can impact large groups of people. And so the difference is most likely in the healing. So I have a tagline for one of my companies called From Mass Trauma to Collective Healing. We need each other. We need to be connected with each other. We need community. We need connection with each other as human beings to heal from mass trauma. And that's what makes this pandemic so difficult, and especially for children, because children take their cues from us, the adults in their lives, the primary caregivers in their lives, teachers. And we don't know how to deal with it. I mean, I'm learning from a lot of folks in my practice that we as a country are pretty lost in terms of how to deal with this, let alone how to help our kids deal with it. So with mass trauma, and this is truly a mass trauma, it is the first time in human history where we have had from a psychological standpoint, things that stress us are called stressors. So this is the first time in human history we have had one single stressor that has affected the entire population of the globe. And we have been able to be connected with the internet and be able to gather data. And so from a scientific point of view, this is truly unique for people like me who are interested in the science behind this. The problem is that we've never done it before. So in one sense, as a researcher, that's sort of exciting for me. But in another sense, as a human being, as a parent, as a person in my community, a leader, it's difficult for me. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but what I really want to hit home is that mass trauma needs to be healed in community and collectively.
And I want to circle back to that when we kind of get to what our country could be doing right now. But you hit on a couple of really important points. I mean, the idea that this is the first time that there's just one single stressor that is affecting everyone across the globe. I mean, you know, I was already looking at it as one of those moments, pivotal moments in one's life that we'll be talking about for generations. You know, people might talk about, you know, the Depression, or they may even, you know, people that were around when there was the Spanish flu, or, you know, things like that. This is something people are going to be talking about. But, you know, I just hadn't even really just thought, of course, yes, it is the entire globe. You're right that, you know, the coronavirus has really kind of shut things down for us in a lot of ways. So now, what impact has the pandemic had on how you're helping them cope? Because this is kind of a different thing. How has it changed, or how have you had to meet this moment?
Well, people are suffering more. And so I want to add on to what you said a little bit. So the pandemic itself, you know, the fear of losing a loved one or losing a loved one, all the things that have to do with the potential of or being infected with the virus and all of the things that happen because of that is one layer. But there are other layers, like not being able to see grandkids, not being able to, you know, touch each other. I was talking to someone on a podcast a few days ago, and he was talking about not being able to soothe someone at a funeral. And so, like, at a funeral, we're distanced, right, appropriately for, you know, for public health reasons. But when you see someone you've known for a long time who's lost a loved one and you can't even hug them, from a neuroscience point of view, I think that's going to have long-term effects on us. And, you know, with that, kind of like you said in the beginning, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There are things that we can do about it. But I also want to say that the American Psychological Association just released their annual Stress in America poll results. And we are seeing the first significant rise in average stress levels since 2007. And it's because of the pandemic. And it's even worse for American parents of children under 18. So on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 would indicate little or no stress, and then 10 indicates a great deal of stress, I think it was, I don't know what the percentage, 90-some-odd percent of parents felt that their stress was like 7 and above. So we are seeing the results of it. We are also seeing increases in alcohol abuse, domestic violence. A lot of this is sort of coming down on the nuclear family, and absolutely it impacts kids negatively, right? So, you know, what do we do about it?
Right. And, you know, and again, this is kind of like where, I mean, it's affecting all of us, and we're all processing it differently. But like I, you know, what I'm seeing just in my community and say family or, you know, circle of friends, you know, people that are normally unruffled kind of are able to just take things as they come. I mean, and I even feel like I'm in that category sometimes. But there are moments when I realize how much this is affecting me. And it's not just the pandemic or, you know, the coronavirus aspect of the pandemic, it's kind of this next piece that I want to get into as well, where, you know, in the beginning, we were really just focused on the virus and how to avoid catching it and all of that. But then, of course, really quickly, there was, you know, another enemy reemerged. And it's, you know, our racist history that just really hasn't been dealt with. And just the contentious, again, election cycle. And like I didn't realize until election day and inauguration day how much I had been carrying. And so right. I'm wondering how these other pieces of the pandemic, because, you know, really, when I look back, you know, years from now, when I'm telling the story to grandchildren or whatever, and I talk about the pandemic, these other things are going to be part of it as well. And so how are those other pieces showing up in your work?
Right. So, like mass trauma, like any other trauma, tends to accumulate over time unless it's effectively processed. And what I mean by that is that the cyclical experience, the stress and strain of dealing with abnormal situations, traumatic situations, build up the longer you experience them until you either resolve it healthily or people also can shut down and completely burn out, right? So then an entire community, and in this instance, the African American community, is forcibly trapped in this cycle. There's no surprise that the community will continually attempt to address and resolve the ongoing trauma and alleviate the strain. And of course, that there's also transgenerational trauma, which is where you know, your forefathers, my forefathers, and mothers as well, handed down their experience. So, in my opinion, for the African American community, just being brought here into America against their will, right? That was traumatic. And we now have evidence that when a parent is traumatized, it actually changes their DNA. And then when they parent or produce children, that changed, traumatized, if you will, but just changed. DNA gets passed on to the next generation. So African-Americans are dealing with generation after generation of transgenerational trauma on top of the ongoing racism and structural racism here in our country. And then now we've got a pandemic, and then Black Lives Matter, you know, that appropriate response happened in 2020 as well, right? 2019 to 2020, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, this, and again, remember that trauma is cumulative. So there's trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma. And, you know, the idea is to learn ways to process and sort of move it. Basically, what happens is trauma can be processed in a way that it gets filed back into your brain as a normal memory. So it's traumatic memories get filed in your brain in sort of a different place, and they're accessed differently. But I did want to say that we have received 2020 data showing that the rising trend in African-American stress over racial discrimination, I think there was 2/3 of respondents indicated that racial discrimination is a significant stressor, there's that word again, in their lives. So, and it's on the rise, and understandably so, but, you know, again, does it make it easier just because we know it? You know, we have to kind of do something about it.
Right. And I hope, I mean, that's the thing. If we could deal with it, like acknowledge it and deal with it, you know, it would be better for everybody. And right. I mean, but it's going to keep, it keeps circling, keeps coming back and just coming back with more force and whatever, because we haven't dealt with it. And that's just with, you know, anything in your life. It might be a bad habit or, you know, just say gambling, just, you know, to make it simple. But it's just going to keep coming back until you look at why you're gambling, why you're destroying, you know, your well-being, your finances and whatever. And or if you keep owing people money, they're going to be coming. They might get, you know, they might ease off because they're doing something else, but they're going to come back. They're going to eventually come back because you haven't settled you haven't taken care of the issue. And I really wish that our country could get to a place of recognizing that, like, you know. So what then are some signs? Well, okay.
Can I just add to that? Because that is, so just to help people understand sort of how to process things, how important it is. So I kind of came across this when I was talking with somebody who has a podcast. It's for unhoused people. It's called We the Unhoused. And he asked me to come on his podcast and help people who didn't have a home understand how to process their trauma. And when I started going down the list in my head of the things that are necessary to process trauma, I couldn't even go there because they don't have homes, so they're not safe. So let me just give you some of the things that have to be in place to be able to start to process and heal trauma. So number one is emotional safety. So if the African American community does not have emotional safety, which I would argue they don't, at least in large part, then they that community can't start to heal, right? If a traumatized person or a traumatized community is not feeling heard, well, you know, hello, right? Not feeling heard, then you can't really start to process and move through that trauma and heal it and kind of put it behind you. And there were numerous things. So, I think that's what you're saying, but I wanted to put it into this sort of a scientific context that until our nation, like you said, recognizes, and I would think that would mean, you know, really listen and make changes based on that listening, and create safety and true equity, then I don't know how the African American community is going to begin to heal. And if one of the communities in our society can't heal, then we can't ever heal as a country, right?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Now, on an individual basis, what are some signs that someone might need to seek counseling or treatment to deal with this turbulent moment, you know, as opposed to I'll just take care of it myself?
Well, there are lots of different things you can look for. So, sleep disturbances, eating more or less. One of them is, it's really specific to trauma, it's called hypervigilance. So someone who is always aware of what's going on around them, they're extra jumpy, or they startle easy. What else? And if you get into more severe post-trauma symptoms, people can have flashbacks. But one of the things to really watch for in children is withdrawal. So a lot of times children cope with trauma by sort of becoming invisible, especially in cases of domestic violence. I know we're not talking about that, but that's something that's very near and dear to my heart, obviously. So, any change in behavior for children is something for parents and adults to pay attention to. In adults, it can manifest, like if you're currently going through this and you're, you know, we're in it right now, we're still in it, and it's like it's not going to go away anytime soon. So things like sort of being overly involved or a little obsessed about it, always checking and watching the news over and over again, those kinds of things can be difficult. But the main distinguishing thing within the psychology community is that if it's impacting your work or private life in a significant manner, so if you're having a hard time connecting with your spouse or you withdraw yourself, again, sleeping, sleep disturbances, early morning waking, trouble going to sleep, sleeping too much, there are lots of things that can really sort of present as symptoms of being in trauma or being post-trauma.
I'm trying to, just trying to think where I want to go. My goodness.
I know, it's so much, right? I mean, it's just so much.
Yeah, let's circle back, because I don't want to lose this. You were describing some building blocks for the healing from trauma, and you said there should be emotional safety in place. And number two, You should feel heard. Is there anything else that you think needs to be there to help this happen?
Well, so one of the things that, yes, I mean, one of the things that is really important is to avoid triggering situations. So if I could just set a little groundwork for this, this is something that's really helpful. It's a concept called the window of tolerance. So if you were to take a piece of paper, like let's say a tablet, and you were to draw two lines in it, across it, and you were to divide it with those two lines into three equal spaces. So if you can visualize that, then the middle space is what we call in the trauma literature the window of tolerance. And that's where you and I are likely right now. You know, we're having a conversation. It's not entirely a happy conversation, but it's, you know, we're dealing with stuff that's meaningful to me. I'm hoping it's meaningful to your audience. And so what's happening is that we are in this sort of neutral place. And in that, the blood in our brains is circulating around in a normal way, and it's perfusing and nourishing all the parts of our brain, okay? If we are startled or if something scary happens, what happens is our brain receives a threat signal, and it's in our old brain, which just means that it tells our body to automatically respond. We don't have any real control over this. So most people are familiar with what's called fight flight, and that's when you get a threat signal and your heart races, and if you're going to public speak, that's the number one adult phobia. Most people are familiar with getting on stage and having a little bit of nervousness. That's when you start to go up towards the window of tolerance. Once you cross the window of tolerance and you go to the top, it's called hyperarousal, overarousal, and fight flight, right? So the way we were created, when our brains got a threat signal, like say a long time ago, so the cave bear comes out of the woods and my brain goes, oh, cave bear, threat signal. My eyes dilate, my pupils dilate, my heart races, the blood goes from my extremities to my core, and all of these amazing things happen so I can fight the bear or flee the bear. Hopefully I run away from the bear and don't try to fight it. But in doing so, the action, the movement of fighting or fleeing is there to dispel some of the chemicals. And then that's meant to be a short period of time. We either fight the bear, probably get eaten, or run away and hopefully get away safely. But it's a short time. Then our bodies go back to normal and we go back in the window of tolerance. The bottom of the window of tolerance is called hypoarousal, under arousal, or sometimes collapse. And sometimes people literally collapse from a traumatic situation or event, right? So what happens, so there are strategies to get ourselves back into the window of tolerance. So the sympathetic nervous system is what is called, what is responsible for the fight-flight symptoms, right? And the parasympathetic nervous system is what tells our body to calm down. So when we are in above the window of tolerance in hyperarousal, we want to engage the parasympathetic nervous system, and I'm happy to give you several tools before we get off today to do that. And then if we're in collapse and we're like really sort of tired and in under arousal, you can actually sort of flap your skin, and there's a technique to do that to kind of bring your sympathetic nervous system back online. So the interesting thing is, and this might tie back into your question about how do you know if someone has experienced trauma or a lot, a potential trauma, I call it, or a lot of stress. The blood. So let me give you my research definition of trauma. Trauma is the sensory and emotional experience of feeling helpless to protect oneself or loved ones. So if you apply that to a community, there's a helplessness there because you're not safe and not being heard, right? So when you experience high levels of stress and potential trauma, the blood goes to the right side of your brain. That's the sensory and emotional part, right? It also goes to the back part of your brain. And what often happens is that because it's moved to those places, it's moved away from the left side of the brain. And our language area, Broca's area, is in the sort of front left side of our brain. And we have functional MRIs that show when people are recalling traumatic events, the blood goes away from Broca's area, and Broca's area can actually go completely dark. And we have evidence, I work with a lot of first responders, that when people have like a car accident, they literally cannot talk. So one of those indicators of someone who has met with trauma or is recalling trauma is that they have a hard time putting their thoughts together. So when people are up in fight flight, the blood is moved away from Broca's area and they may have a hard time sort of finishing their sentences. Often they'll say, oh, just forgot what I was going to say. It's right there on the tip of my tongue and I forgot. And so that's sort of the mechanics of it, right? And that's how I've based the way I approach trauma in my work, is understanding the neuroscience behind the human brain and the body and how it all works together, and then creating proprietary techniques and tools to help people work with their with the way we're made, right, to mitigate those symptoms. And so I really work toward preventing, mitigating, and processing or recovering from trauma.
And some of that, what you're talking about, is the somatic piece that you incorporate into your treatment?
Correct.
Like where you talked, where you talked about, engaging the parasympathetic system, like particularly when you're just too flat, you're underreacting to mm-hmm. what's going on. Yeah, that's powerful. So we're hearing a lot about, the focus is right now on, still testing, but definitely vaccines. And so do you have any sense of how, the powers that be are assigning money and manpower toward mental health support for us during this time? Because we talked about it in the beginning of the show about this mass trauma and the importance of collective healing. So do you you know anything about that? I mean, about how much attention they're paying to that?
From what I know, and I don't know at all, obviously, I would say not enough. And I think it's because right now, and again, there may be people who are putting more money and attention on this, and I'm just not aware of it. However, I do believe that the attention is on vaccinating people and keeping people from dying. I mean, we're in a really, we're in a very emergent place right now, right? I mean, we're in an emergency situation. And so I feel like survival is kind of in the front of everybody's mind, sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? You have to survive first before you can kind of take care of the higher order needs, right? But I'm doing it. And I have a program that works, with organizations and schools and that kind of stuff. But I don't know of anybody else who's doing the sort of community-based healing work that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know. I mean, I know that it seems like Washington is really focused on, and Biden, thank God, is really focused on getting people vaccinated and trying to get our immunity up and really trying to save people who are already sick, right? So hopefully that'll come. I mean, I'm hoping that the federal government will start, and even the state and local governments will start realizing that this has been a long-term traumatic event. It's ongoing, and that is just more damaging and hurtful to people and their mental health.
Yes, and I can certainly agree with what you're saying about the fact that the vaccine and all of that should take priority. I feel like in our country we just don't have a good track record of once we confront something in the moment, it's an emergency. We don't do well with the underlying the underlying causes of things. We just kind of, attack what we can see, what has, what has reared its head, and we don't do some of that other work. So I just wasn't sure, if given, the field that you're in, if, you might have some knowledge about that. But I mean, I really hope so, that someone is thinking a step ahead. I mean, again, it's even the example, I could also use the example of how there was this, warp speed race to get the vaccine, but then how much thought was given to how we were going to distribute them, we're in this situation now where, you know, some vaccines are going to waste or people aren't getting, they have appointments, but then, you know, they show up there and the vaccines aren't there, or different things. So I just feel, you know, that's an example of how we focus. You know, it's good to focus in the moment, but I just hope that, you know, that we've got somebody for that next step the healing.
We have to, because, I think there was, I mean, I don't think I can sort of ignore the political infighting and how horrific it became. And I feel like a lot of attention had to be focused on that, because it was too much, right? But I feel like things have settled down now, and it does look like the vaccines are going to be rolling out in more organized ways. And I heard last night that that the federal government is going to ship directly to pharmacies. Well, that's a brilliant idea. I mean, I feel very frustrated that this didn't happen earlier, but it is happening now. And I think that we can do more than one thing. And I'm totally with you, Carol. I believe that we can roll out these vaccines, get them in people's arms, start creating some, you know, moving toward herd immunity. Also, at the same time, start to deal with our mental health. I was speaking to someone yesterday. She was from another country, and she's here working as a physician now. And she was telling me that she said mental health issues here are just amazingly rampant. She said it's just not this way at home, and you know, people are more calm. And I think we've gotten here. We didn't get here overnight, right? I mean, we are a very stressed out society, and I've been saying this way before COVID. I mean, I started sort of calling out for not just mental health. It is mental health work, but not just therapy, but just every single person in America could do well to educate themselves, or, you know, try some things, try meditation, try, an exercise program. There's so many things that we can do to be resilient and not wait until we're really mentally or psychologically in deep pain. We really can take the reins into our hands and be preventative about it. And it's the same way with trauma. The best way to deal with trauma is to, as soon as you realize you or your child or your family member or loved one has been through something that's really been potentially traumatic, is to get to processing it and seek an expert in trauma. Unfortunately, there are a lot of therapists who just are not trained in trauma. And it's a real specific specialty. So, I'm with you. I think we really have to focus on healing. And we haven't really dealt with a lot of stuff for so long that it's kind of a big pile in front of us. And we're going to have to start shoveling it out.
If you could design a way for communities to heal, what kinds of things would you like to see done, to help bring about that community healing?
Well, I have, it's a program that I have used an organization, but an organization is a culture and a community. But in terms of how we roll it out now, it would have to be virtual. But I do have courses, and I teach this stuff because I've worked with it for a long time, but I truly believe it's the foundation of who we are and how we raise our children, how we are as community members. We have to develop ways to sort of ongoingly cope with stress and trauma. It's sort of not enough to wait until you get into a car accident or something really horrible happens. We all, in my opinion, should be moving toward processing stress and trauma on a daily basis. And so the things that I teach a foundational breathing exercise that is really important. I teach every single client or group that I work with this foundational breathing technique, and I'll go through it super, super, super simple. I didn't make this up. This has been around for millennia, actually. Basically, you breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. And what that does is it stimulates something called the vagus nerve, which runs up the inside of your spine, and that engages the parasympathetic nervous system. So the very first go-to thing I teach people is if you're feeling sort of up toward fight flight and you're anxious and just can't deal with anymore, start with breathing. That's one of the best things you can do. There's a caveat to it. A lot of people think that the answer to stress is meditation and breathing, and it's not the only answer. What I recommend, and this goes back to the window of tolerance and fight flight and what I talk to you about that. So a lot of people get into situations where they're completely flooded, and you can tell when your child is flooded too. They've just, you know, it's like when a two-year-old has just had it, like they just can't cope anymore. Well, four-year-old, six-year-old, 16-year-old, 36-year-old, we all get to that point, right? So when you're there and you're truly like just tapped out, the best thing you can do is move. So jumping jacks are your friend. I coach the top leaders of the Air Force and the Space Force, and I often say if you can't do jumping jacks because you're in a position where you can't be seen, just excuse yourself to the restroom. I tell all my clients this. Go to the restroom and do air squats. You want to engage large muscle groups. And what that does is it sort of replicates running from the bear or fighting the bear. You're moving your body, blood through your body. You're getting the chemicals sort of dissipated. And then you can go to something like breathing or meditation. So there's just all kinds of tips and tricks and things to do. The number one thing I would tell people for their children and themselves is turn off the TV. You just don't need to have this stuff going in your head over and over and over again. You know, when I'm asked to look at a police shooting, I watch it exactly twice. I do not ever watch it over and over again. The first time I watch it, and this is if I was to give analysis, right? The first time I watch it, I just watch it as a human being, and I let it just hit me, my whole being, my stomach, my heart, my throat. I let myself just react to it as a human being. And then I take about an hour or more break, and I don't think about it. I go do something that engages my mind, and I put it out of my mind. The second time, I watch it from a traumatologist perspective, just to really look at and pay attention to and identify signs of trauma and being in fight flight, you know, prior to, during, and after the shooting. And then I don't look at it again. If I didn't have to look at those situations, I wouldn't. I would probably read about them and do my, you know, respond as a community member. But I wouldn't watch it over and over again. And the reason is our brains do not know the difference. So that's why visualization and meditation and those things work really well for us. When our brain is watching something traumatic on TV, it, especially if it's news and you know it's real, it doesn't differentiate between it happening right now in real time for you or whether it happened last week and you're just watching it on the news. So every time you watch something upsetting, traumatizing, and the same with your kids, their brain and body is responding just as if it were happening for real right now.
Yes. I mean, it's been over the last few years, honestly, as we've heard about different incidents, in particular, police-involved incidents with people in the Black and brown communities. I can't watch the thing. Like you said, I will read about it, like George Floyd. I have not looked at that. I mean, and there's some of it I can't avoid because, you know, there's certain points in that encounter that they show in the news stories and whatever, like the still image. But I did not watch that video, and I just started, just making that choice. But, you know, to your example about how the brain has difficulty differentiating between, really processing it, when the Capitol, when that was going on, and that was in real time when they were showing that on the news, I mean, that was the first time in a long time. I just got really amped up. I was mad. I was yelling at the TV. I mean, there's so many emotions going through my mind. Like, that's my hometown, right?
Right.
And And I've taken my children there, you know, multiple times, and my niece, and, you know, we have these beautiful pictures of this beautiful building that, you know, is representative of our country and, you know, and all that goes on there. And I just, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe how I was just really, how it really affected me. And I mean, you know, we haven't spent a lot of time together, but anybody will tell you, I'm just really kind of low key. I mean, the way I respond things,
I know you are.
I'm very reserved kind of a person, but it drove me crazy. I was so angry. I mean, I was caught up in it. Like, you know, I was a few feet away or something, you know, it took me a long time to come down from that.
Yeah. And I think that's really representative of where we are as a country. And a lot of stuff has accumulated. And that just seems like sort of the final straw for a lot of people. I do crisis coaching where people can go on my Calendly or go to my website, and if they're in crisis, they can call me, and it rings through to me 24/7. And I have gotten more crisis calls from my clients, but also from people just like, I just need somebody to talk to. Like, I can't process this. I just can't do it. And the anger and the frustration. And then again, I think it made us feel unsafe. If our capital can be stormed and that perimeter breached and people can go in and threaten our leaders, then what does that mean for the rest of us, right? I mean, it truly shook the foundation. I did a podcast on this. I have a podcast called The Traumatic States of America. And I did an episode about that. And one of the things that I think I talked about, I might have thought about it, but because I think a lot of that stuff, especially when it's trauma related. But I've had some people retain me for some work because they were inside the Capitol, right? Like during the incident. Mm-hmm. So law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the fact that So it was a mob, right? So we have a lot of research in the psychology literature about the mob and mob mentality and how people will do things they would never do, blah, blah, blah. But I was thinking for the people who were inside, the senators, mm-hmm. Secret Service, you know, those mm-hmm. folks were on the other end of that mob. And I have mm-hmm. to think, I don't know this, but I haven't looked into it, but I have to think that being on the receiving end of a mob has to be terrifying. And I think it's probably deeply wired into our brains because, like I said a long time ago, if a pack of wolves came after us, we had to know that was really dangerous. And I feel like it was that kind of fear. Like when when I watched the African-American inside the man who was, I think he was Secret Service, or maybe he was Capitol Police.
Oh, you mean the guard that was running up the steps,
yes.
and he diverted them from where the senators were. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that gentleman. So that would be what I would call high stakes performance. And maybe we can have another time we talk about this. But basically, for him to be able to have the presence of mind to be in that situation, which is terrifying, the blood, we can say the blood went to the back of his brain. But he had the ability to somehow access his frontal lobe. And they say that I see the video once or twice, but he looked toward, I think, the Senate and realized.
He looked left.
He looked left. And then he went right, right? So he mm-hmm. threw mm-hmm. them away on purpose, which gives me, you know, he has to have had just an amazing presence of mind. And But
he shoved the guy up front. He shoved the guy up front to draw him,
right.
Kind of draw him to him. That was really powerful. And, you know, it's just amazing and just such a blessing that he was thinking that way, because apparently that corridor was where seconds earlier, the Secret Service had pulled Vice President Mike Pence to safety.
Right.
So, and actually the door wasn't even closed yet, too. So, that was really a powerful image of bravery and quick thinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have to tell you, Dr. Lori, I'm over here. I'm really taking all kinds of notes here. I mean, and it's just, wow. I mean, and for a minute there, I mean, thankfully, you know, you had so much more to share with us. I mean, I had to really, again, thinking about those images on the Capitol, right, even here in this interview. I mean, it just really brought up emotions in me again, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really a lot that, you know, our country is having to deal with right now. Now, you did share some strategies that listeners can practice to help them ride out the storm. And this is, of course, aside from seeking professional help, you know, if, as you said, that their lives are being impacted, you know, on a daily basis, they're just not able to do and function the way they're used to. That there's some things that you can just do, and you talked about the breathing, the movement, turning off the TV, and then also just, I mean, I kind of paraphrase what I thought you were saying, and that is just to control your diet, your media diet, being, you know, in terms of the types of things that you're exposing yourself to and allowing yourself to see. To help you to get through this period of trauma. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Sure. I mean, there's tons of things, but just for the, you know, getting our time together, I would say play. So this sounds maybe a little off topic, but it's really not. So play. So if we look at other mammals, like, you know, other animals, they become non-playful about the time they have reached sexual maturity. But so human beings, our brains are wired to play throughout our entire lifespan. And we kind of stop because we get really serious. And I know these are serious times. I'm not minimizing that at all. But to the extent that you can play, and play is defined in this context as something that you do, that you enjoy, that has no end product or, you know, end game, right? So if you like to play music, I like to dance. I like to dance and enjoy music. But volleyball or a board game or anything, and I would encourage parents to do this for themselves and between, you know, with adult partners or whatever, and then also with their children, because when you truly allow your mind to go towards something playful, you kind of rest it from all the rest of the stuff, and it does tend to rejuvenate. And there's all kinds of, I do a whole talk on play and how important it is to human beings. So that would be really important. And just moving is really great. Any kind of exercise helps to restabilize things. Breathing is great. I have something called somatic rescripting that I work with people on. It's more detailed and helps to get kind of sort of deeply kind of clear out trauma. But yeah, just, and connection, human connection, and being around people who make you feel safe, physically, emotionally, mentally, psychologically safe is super important.
Well, thank you so much for that. I mean, especially play, you know, and you know, these last two that you shared on the importance of play and connecting. Now, let me ask you, is there anything that you have coming up that you would like to share with our listeners, or if there's anything, you know, that you're doing, there's something on your site or something that they can look at, anything that you'd like to leave them with?
Yeah, so I've been working with my high stakes performance, which is a performance work with top athletes and fire pilots and Air Force leaders and that kind of stuff for a long time. But I'm rolling out a beginner level course on high stakes performance, and it will basically help people learn how to maximize their potential, but it also minimizes burnout, and especially during this global pandemic. So it'll be focused on right now, what's going on with us right now. And the course is really designed to bring relief to people and then set them up for a healthier, happier, less stressful life moving forward, but really kind of get them through this. So yeah, I have a course. It'll be on my website, which is LoriHoodPhD.com. And that that is, I created that specifically at a just the foundational level to give people all of this stuff, but under some supervision so that I can answer questions and sort of be there for people as they move through this. Because it does process stuff and bring stuff up. But it's basically psychoeducation. It's not anything super deep. But I think it's helpful just to know how our brains work and how you can apply these tools and techniques that I've created to help yourself get through the pandemic.
Well, let me ask you about that course. So is that something that you can do on your own, and then there's like checkpoints where they talk to you, or, you know, is it a group thing, or I'd love to hear more about that.
So I have three levels, and the three levels are I do a class that I teach in real time via Zoom. So I have that course.
Okay.
And then I have one that is what I call blended, and that is half-time teaching and checking in. So, but then people do work on their own where they go and they watch recorded things, and then they take a test, and then they check in with me, you know, every once in a while, and we have a discussion session based on the work. So they're more independent. And then there's one that's completely independent. So people can go and watch a recorded session that I taught previously, and or recorded just for this one, and just learn the material. And then of course they can set up a meeting with me to talk about their specific, you know, their individual lives and how it's affected them personally.
Okay, thank you. And I want to remind our listeners that you can learn more about Dr. Lori Hood at LoriHood.com. So that's LoriHoodPhD.com. And I want to remind you that you can learn about some of the upcoming events that I have going on at CarolMaletta.com. Please follow me also on the Parenting 411 on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. I will highlight a couple of things that I have coming up, in that I will be a panelist and a moderator at the Future is Now Virtual Conference 2021. Speakers there will be addressing Black economics and community empowerment. I will be on a panel with Black women talking about the intersection of their various roles. And I will also be moderating a panel to look at the impact of media representation on Black men and boys. You can sign up for that conference at www.thefutureisnowconference.com. And on February 19th, I will be speaking at the I Am a Victor Summit. IamAVictorSummit.com. You can register there. It is free. It will be on February 19th, starting at 9 a.m., and you will just hear from speakers with very inspiring, motivational stories telling you about how they overcame obstacles and emerged victoriously. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Thank you again, Dr. Lori Hood. I can imagine that I'm really going to need to have you come back and talk about some some other topics. You do a lot of fascinating work. I'm particularly interested in human potential. I really want to talk to you about that. But thank you again, and thank you again, listeners, and everybody have a great weekend. And I do it a thousand times again.